Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 725. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. We have a very special conversation coming your way today. It's always nice when we have even a quasi-milestone type show like 725 to be able to bring on a special guest and really get into a conversation with somebody who is as distinguished as this gentleman. We have on a longtime NFL player turned broadcaster and businessman. You can, of course, find him these days presently on 790 AM in Houston. And, of course, all information that you want to find about this guy, everything he is up to, particularly a lot of his business ventures, you can find at ndkalu.com, ndkalu.com. So I guess that breaks the mystery somewhat. Our guest today is longtime NFL player turned broadcaster and businessman, Andy Kalu, on to talk NFL draft, the state of the game presently, any number of other things that come to mind with him. It's a pleasure to get him on the program. We've had a little bit in common with him over a period of time in terms of some of our beloved recurring guests. I understand they've been on his show as well, Lex Luger and our good friend Vernon Turner, among others. By the way, if you haven't already, check out Vernon Turner's column from the Players Tribune last week. It is blowing up everywhere. Vernon himself, a Houston native right now, is, I think, getting some very deserved attention for his outstanding life story, which I understand has been spotlighted previously on Andy's program in Houston. But it's a pleasure to welcome this gentleman to the show today to have a good football conversation with him. Andy Kalu, welcome to the program, sir. It's nice to have you. How are you today?
Man, I'm good. I really appreciate you. How are you doing?
Oh, doing great, thanks. Wonderful to be able to get a chance to talk NFL with you. We just went through a very unprecedented NFL draft any number of ways. I guess the most obvious one would be everything that happened with Laremy Tunsil in the first round. And when we did our immediate post-draft analysis, I remember commenting that it was almost like something out of a screenplay. You could almost imagine somebody trying to put something together, a scenario where somebody is being blackmailed or undermined and such a way, but this video leaking out literally 10 minutes before the draft, going on to Tunsil's social media, a subsequent one later on that night on Instagram. What were your thoughts as a past player looking at this? I mean, I'm sure for anybody that's ever played the game, there's a lot of empathy for anything that anybody else is going through, but you just had to be scratching your head like the rest of us because this is something we've never seen before.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, being a part of the draft, following the draft, I'm a huge football fan, so not just a former player, but even before playing in the NFL, I'd watch the draft. Even after my days, you know, when I retired in 2009, I still watched the draft. And like you mentioned, it was like something I'd never seen. And I went through mixed emotions. You know, first I was upset with Laremy Tunsil. I was thinking to myself, how could you be so idiotic to, one, break the law, then record it? You know, what good could come out of that? Then I actually started to empathize and feel sorry for him because I had to remind myself, yeah, that's you, the 40-year-old, talking, but what were you doing at 21? And I believe he was a teenager when he was doing that. And I was not smoking weed. I'm not getting on some moral, you know, soapbox. But at the same time, I've done some things that I wouldn't want people to view and the entire public to judge. And I was thinking, okay, we've all made mistakes, especially at that early age, especially when you're detached from reality. You know, you think you're invincible because you're playing big-time college football. So for someone to put that out when it was supposed to be a special day for Laremy, for his family, for his friends, you know, his coaches, I did feel sorry for him. But when it was all said and done, I truly believe that this is going to be a silver lining, a blessing in disguise, because he's been embarrassed publicly. And I just get the sense that he's not going to make that kind of mistake, or he's going to be more aware of his surroundings. And it's going to be a good thing for Laremy Tunsil and a great thing for the Miami Dolphins.
You have to think so in that way. That does seem likely. There's nothing like burning your hand on the stove to make you want to resolve not to do that again. One can't help but wonder, though, if the Mississippi program might be as fortunate going forward here. That was another part of the saga that unfolded that night. Coach Hugh Freeze is there with him at the draft. He's supporting Laramie, the other Ole Miss stars there, the three first-rounders among them. And then the news comes out later in the night about Tunsil having these conversations where he appears to cop to taking some money. And then, again, I think probably in the haze and the shock of everything that was happening there, really it kind of came off in a way of throwing the program under the bus, a little bit of, maybe I should take a little bit of money there, you know. So what were your thoughts about that? Because I know that's been something that's been commented on, I'd say almost as more of a character issue than the bong video itself, because you could scratch off the bong video, kids being stupid, whatever, but the notion of not necessarily protecting the people who are there for you, like your college head coach who's there with you at the draft. Again, not that it's necessarily a capital offense or anything, but what were your thoughts on that and what that kind of showed in terms of loyalty?
You know what, I'm huge on loyalty, but I actually had a different take than you did if we're going off the same press conference, because I remember the press conference where they asked him a bunch of questions, and they truly caught him off guard. Because if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, when he was in front of the cameras, in front of the mic, that was the first time that he learned that they hacked into his Instagram or Twitter, and they told him, yes, we have the messages of you asking Coach for money. Because the first time he tried to deny it, then when he realized that they had it right there, he made a decision, was like, oh, crap, they caught me red-handed and said yes. So I didn't take it as a situation like you see these guys who don't make it and they go back and turn on the school who helped them with some handouts. I saw it as a situation where it was like, oh, we got you right where we want you. There's cameras here. We're asking you and we're telling you we have the proof. So it just felt like he had no choice but to fess up.
That's a good point. I mean, he might have just felt like he was cornered in that moment and probably really didn't know which way to react on that. That's a very good point.
Right, because they actually said that we're looking at the tweets or the texts or whatever it may be right now. And they asked him the question. It was like, oh, yeah, okay. Then he went back and said, yeah, I did accept it. It just didn't come off to me as he was trying to throw them under the bus. It was one of those deals where – and I would question – you know, we're always looking for people to blame. But I would question the Miami Dolphins PR, knowing that everything that went down – I feel that would be one time you kind of control the questions and control what's going on until everything has been figured out. But to just throw him out there while all his information was being hacked, I felt like they kind of – they didn't leave him a choice to be loyal.
Well, this is a very interesting line of discussion when we're talking about crisis management and how to get through something because – again, I had a take that might be kind of surprising coming out of the mouth of a lifelong Clevelander like myself, but for some of the people in the media that were bashing the Ravens for not taking him because allegedly they did have him higher on their board than Ronnie Stanley and it passed on him because who knows what to make of it in the course of the draft there. It's all unfolding in real time. That was something that seemed really, really kind of unfair to me. The people were like, oh, the Ravens choked. I mean, how do the Ravens know what else is out there? You know, at the very least, somebody is sabotaging this kid. That much is true because it's pretty clear he's not going to be doing this to himself. So if the kid has a powerful enemy, that in and of itself is enough to make you go, uh-oh. So that was kind of another angle to the night that I thought was interesting. All the teams that passed on, not least of which my Cleveland Browns, I'm going to give everybody a pass on that because this was a perfectly timed sneak attack. It was designed to plant that kind of seed of doubt in everybody's head, and human nature being what it is, it was effective. I personally don't fault any of the teams for falling for that seed of doubt and wondering what else might have been out there. I wonder what you think about that.
You know what? I'm with you 100%. I applaud the Miami Dolphins for doing whatever quick due diligence they had to do and taking that chance more so than me saying that the Baltimore Ravens or the Cleveland Browns, that they missed the bus or that they did a disservice to their team by not drafting him. Because just like you mentioned, their biggest concern is like, oh, man, if this is happening now, what else is there that we don't know about? I do believe if every team knew, okay, this is what he did, this is the worst that they have on him, that he was smoking marijuana from a gas mask, I believe he would have gone higher. But at the time that this came out, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe that's when the tweets were coming out and other things were coming out, that they were wondering if there was going to be some kind of grand finale, and they didn't want to spend that pig. So I do not condemn them for not drafting him. I more so applaud the Miami Dolphins for doing it. And it's similar, I don't know if you remember last year, Lael Collins, the offensive lineman from LSU, who had a first-round grade, and he completely fell out of the draft because right before the draft, his ex-girlfriend, who happened to be pregnant, was murdered. And it comes to find out he did not have anything to do with it. But during the timing, they didn't know if he was a suspect, if he had anything to do with it, and he doesn't get drafted at all. Then when his name is cleared, you know, Jerry Jones rushes and has him out to his house and wines and dines him and signs him to a contract. And it's one of those deals where I felt bad for the kid, but if I was a GM, I don't know if I would have said, oh, I'll draft him. You know, I'll take his word for it. Not when you're talking murder, not in an era when we had Aaron Hernandez, when we had the Ray Rice incident, you know, so many black eyes on the sport of football. I don't blame people being overly cautious, but I do commend the ones who go out and take a chance on one of these young guys.
Absolutely, yeah. And in this day and age, and there are certainly franchises that are less equipped to take any kind of risks. I would harken back to my own Cleveland Browns, looking at the 17 years of being back in the league, keeping the risks at a minimum would seem to be a smart thing to do, and risk aversion seemed to be a big part of their strategy this year. They, of course, played into one of the very big stories of the draft, and that being the trades at the very top that paved the way for quarterbacks to go 1-2 in both of those spots. Some interesting and risky moves there, but potentially rewarding ones. Jared Goff to the Rams, Carson Wentz to the Eagles. Generally speaking, when you're looking at some of the winners from the night, who were the teams that you came away with as far as being more impressed with what they brought in?
You know, I was very impressed with Jacksonville. You know, I really like what Jacksonville has been doing to build that team, and not just with what they did during the draft this year, but when you look at the two Allen brothers, as they like to call them, the wide receivers that have bright futures, you know, and how they really just beefed up their defense in the offseason. They bring in Malik Jackson. Then with what they did during the draft, I just really like what they're doing. Now, being a former Houston Texan and living here in Houston, rooting for the Houston Texans, I'm taking notice of what's going on in the AFC South and what's going on with the Jacksonville Jaguars. And I just remember, and I'm trying to go back to my notes, mentally go back to my notes, because we did cover the draft, and I believe I had them ranked first or second. And I just remember I was just impressed with the players they were able to get. And then when you factor in what was going on with the team, you know, they drafted Dante Fowler in the first round last year. He suffered a knee injury, and now he's able to come back this year. So it's almost like they're getting that extra draft pick. But, yeah, I definitely was impressed with the Jacksonville Jaguars. And a team that I wasn't impressed with, and I was surprised because I felt like they've drafted so well in the past, the Dallas Cowboys. I just didn't understand taking Jalen Smith that high. I understand Ezekiel Elliott's the number one running back, but I've never liked taking running backs with the, you know, top five pick. I feel like you could always find running back second round, third round. So I wasn't impressed with the Dallas Cowboys, but I do remember Jacksonville just standing out.
Interesting. Let's come back to Elliott in a second. Let's put a bookmark in that because I want to draw you out on that a little bit more. But on Jacksonville, yeah, I think that's worth mentioning because on our own FDH index of the draft, when we were going through and ranking it, on our ranking of pure talent acquired, we had Jacksonville the highest. And it was very interesting because, and I'm sure you noticed this too, they weren't necessarily going for areas of need. They didn't score as high on filling needs in our index as some other teams did. But on raw talent, they scored first on our rankings anyways. But this is part and parcel, if you look at it holistically, part of this offseason that they've had, right? They've had a nice period of free agency here. They've done some other things. So they seem to be a good organization, a good example in terms of using the prior part of the offseason to set up the draft, don't they? Because they seem like they took care of some of their needs and kind of freed themselves up a little bit more to go best player available once the draft rolled around.
No, absolutely. And that's why, you know, when I talk about it, and I know, you know, you're supposed to specifically be focused on just the draft picks, but like you said, with what they did with the entire offseason, then filling the need, you know, Ramsey, Miles, Jack, people that they expected to be, you know, it felt like they got two guys that were both expected to be top 10 type picks. So I was just really impressed with what they did. And their offense with Blake Bortles, their offense was coming along, but we always talked about the defensive defense. And for them to get that much talent on the defensive side of the ball, I was really impressed with what they did.
I hear you. I'm probably going to pick them to make the playoffs this year, but I'm going to look like a real hipster, I'm sure, because I think there's going to be a lot of people on that bandwagon expecting them to make it. As far as the Cowboys go, I want to circle back around to that a little bit. Full disclosure, my dad is a Ohio State season ticket holder, so I have been going to games for years in person at the Shoe. And in watching Elliott play, I mean, I hear you on the one hand, and this is a thing where I think, especially Trent Richardson, that seemed to be a real game changer. When he went very high, unfortunately, again, to my Browns, that's what kind of soured a lot of teams on it, that only if a putback is very, very special. But therein lies the rub, and that's what I want to circle around to, because I've been getting the sense for a while that we may be getting to a little bit of a return of the bell cow in the league here, first with Todd Gurley last year, now with Elliott, Leonard Fournette quite possibly next year. When you look at Elliott running behind that offensive line in Dallas, I've been saying I think he could be a threat for 2,000 yards as a rookie when you pair him up with what they have there. So in terms of the specific circumstances, I liked it. I was surprised they made the pick. I didn't think they were going to do it. But I liked it in terms of that part of it there and maximizing that incredible asset they have with the offensive line. So in light of all of that, I mean, how much were you down on the pick and how much upside do you kind of see now that they've made it anyways?
And again, this is not anything against Ezekiel Elliott.
Right.
If I was a GM, there's two things that I just wouldn't do. And my fan base, you know, if I was a general manager, probably would be upset with me. I wouldn't take a running back in the first round, and I definitely would not take safeties in the first round. I just feel like in my experience that I've played with and I've seen so many great players at that position to where it's not always the exception. You know, you don't – people like to go back deep into history when they're trying to make their point, but I just feel, you know, with the Arian Fosters of the world, the Priest Holmes, Johnson. I think he was a third-round pick, and he was a rookie last year for the Arizona Cardinals. I just feel like you
David Johnson,
so many productive. Yeah, you could name so many productive running backs that didn't go in the first round. You know, I know you have your Adrian Petersons of the world, but even with Adrian Peterson, as great of a running back as he is, having that much production out of your running back, what did it do for the Minnesota Vikings as a team, as an organization? So with Ezekiel Elliott, I think he is going to be great, but I have so much respect for Dallas's offensive line. I just really think that they could have waited to the third round and got a Devontae Booker out of Utah or even a Derrick Henry in the second round. You know, just I just think that offensive line is that productive. And people tend to forget Darren McFadden may not be the answer, but he was fourth in the league in rushing yards last year. You know, he had over 1,000 yards, one of his best seasons, and I think that's largely due to the offensive line. And with them signing Alfred Morris, they already have Darren McFadden. I just don't know if at the number four pick in the entire draft, if they needed to use it on a running back. That's where I really thought Jalen Ramsey was going to go.
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about McFadden being fourth in the league in rushing last year. Yeah, we've heard in the past that it's customary for quarterbacks or running backs to take care of their offensive line, maybe buy them a Rolex all individually if they're having a nice year. Darren McFadden, here's something you know something about real estate. He probably owes all of them big country homes for what they did, right? I mean, at this stage of his career, fourth in the league, I mean, I don't want to necessarily say me or you could have necessarily done that, but that just shows you how almost historically great that offensive line is, doesn't it?
No, you're right, and it's overshadowed because I was just doing some show prep a couple of weeks ago, and I knew Darren McFadden had over 1,000 yards. He had one of his best seasons, but I didn't realize, you know, he was fourth in the league in rushing, and it was considered rushing-wise one of the best running backs in the league because people were comparing him to what happened previously in Dallas with DeMarco Murray having that magical season, then DeMarco Murray leaves from that offensive line, and it's a nightmare. He's already gone from the team that signed him away from Dallas. So, yes, again, it just goes back to my point. With that offensive line, like you said, I'm not going to throw in the hyperbole and say I could have done it or you could have done it, but I do feel like with Alfred Morris, Darren McFadden, you know, picking up a running back in the third round, if you felt like you wanted to groom a young running back, you could have had other options with the number four overall pick.
That's true. There were some really great players available, and they passed on a few great ones because this draft really went six or seven or eight very strong at the top, no question about it. I want to explore also, I love going through these philosophical threads here with a guest when they mentioned something. You threw out also about safeties when you were talking about running backs. That's another thing I'd like to explore with you, just because of my sense that you get some guys that can be what they might call in the military a force multiplier, right, in terms of the effect that they have in terms of not just taking up attention from the defense, what they free up other guys to do. Ronnie Watt is one of the guys that comes to mind when you think about what he did on that 49ers defense in the 80s. And you could think of a couple other ones here, Ed Reed, a couple other guys that are difference makers. I thought Clinton Dix was going to do that for Green Bay. And the funny thing is the game where he probably came the closest was that NFC Championship game that the Packers ended up losing to the Seahawks. But he was a real difference maker then. Much like right. running back, I want to ask you the same question. Are there guys that come out occasionally, I know there probably weren't any this year, but where you look at it and you go, you know, I'm not really generally in favor of this, but I might break that rule and say this guy's a first-round pick in my estimation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that happens every year. Like you mentioned, and I'll get back to safeties, but as far as the philosophy and if there's ever a time where I'll say, typically I wouldn't do this, but let's do it, you know, when Leonard Fournette comes out, you know.
Yeah.
I think you'd be a fool if you need a running back and you don't take Leonard Fournette out of LSU, you know, assuming that he stays healthy and you don't see a drastic change in his production. But as far as strong safety, with as many times as you see nickel and dime in the NFL with all the trips and the four wide receiver sets that these NFL offenses are trending towards, I would even use this as a time and era more so when I wouldn't draft a safety, where I would just draft more cornerbacks, because this is a situation where on your defense, you're in nickel and dime more times than not, where you're bringing in that extra cover guy and not so much someone to play in the box and stop the run. So even if I had two legit NFL starting cornerbacks, I would look at another corner before I look at a safety, just due to the type of defenses and the packages you're going to be facing more times than not.
There was something that I read about. I'm trying to think who it was that drafted that player. I think it might have been the Ravens. Somebody took a player, and I was reading some of the analysis afterwards, where they were saying that this is somebody that could go at either middle linebacker or at safety. And you remember that Urlacher, I think his background was that it was the secondary in college, but that we might be moving more towards that kind of almost like a borderless world here in terms of players going back and forth between middle linebacker and safety. And you got to think that's a really interesting thing that's materializing in the game. I got to think it has part to do with the passing game, the explosion of it with what you're talking about, the explosion of all the nickel and dime packages out there, of having somebody who's fast enough to play safety, can hit hard enough to play middle linebacker. That was another very interesting thought that I had as well when I read that, was that the game may be somewhat kind of blurring the lines in the years to come between the front seven and the secondary a little bit.
Man, you know what? I don't know if it's the same team or the same guy, but there was I was reading during the pre-draft preparation where you're right. There's a guy who was a linebacker, and he was so athletic and a little bit underweight, but not that much underweight, where they said he's such a good playmaker, you could put him at linebacker or safety. And typically when you hear that, you know, I'm a little skeptical. I'm like, look, the NFL at the highest level, you know what position you're going to play somebody. They must not have excelled at one or the other. But it was just like you said, he was so athletic and so good. You could either put him at middle linebacker or safety. And I can't remember the player, but I do remember reading about somebody that had those type of characteristics. But, Jalen Ramsey is a guy who I know he won't play linebacker in the NFL, but at Florida State, he lined up at linebacker, outside linebacker, safety, cornerback. He's that type of athlete that you need in today's game. to defend not just the receivers, but, you know, it's not back when I played in the late 90s, you know, early 2000s, where you had the true tight end. Now these tight ends are just overweight wide receivers, so you definitely have to have extra cover men out there to cover the Jordan Reeds of the world. You're a Cleveland fan, Barnage, who for whatever reason was under the radar, then he has a 1,000-yard season, you know, this past year. Like, where did he come from? But you have so many great pass-catching tight ends. You do need to have those versatile defensive players.
You almost get the sense with some of these trends in the game right now. You know, I always think back to what Mike March did offensively, turn of the century, greatest show on turf, with what he did with the modernization of the spread offense and putting guys all over the field. And I know a lot of people laughed at him when he drafted Trunk candidate high, and that didn't necessarily work out. But that showed you the kind of guts that he had, drafting him when he already had Marshall Faulk. You almost kind of get the sense, don't you, when you look at the defenses that we're like one defensive Mike Martz away from this thing really kind of exploding. I mean, they're already doing a lot more. The lines are already getting blurrier, like you said, sometimes between cornerback and safety, maybe with some of these prospects with middle linebacker and safety. But you almost kind of get the sense that if somebody really goes out there and starts to really tinker with things in that way and try to exploit speed in different ways, it's a copycat league. It could be very exciting to see what would happen if a lot of people would follow that trend.
No, absolutely. I mean, great call by you. I'm actually surprised we haven't seen it sooner. You know, I've envisioned situations where you have three true linemen and 7-8 defensive back types just roaming the field. You know, when you have three guys to make sure they protect the gaps, and now so many of these safeties, these big cornerbacks are so physical, you don't mind if they fill the gap in on the run, but you have them out there to cover all the wide receivers and tight ends. And I'm actually more surprised that we haven't seen that sooner than later. Someone with that Bill Belichick, Mike Martz offensive mentality on the defensive side of the ball. Because, and I know lately, you know, poor tackling, people bring it up and, you know, they'll highlight missed tackles. But when you get to the NFL, you know, there are a bunch of safeties out there that are maybe second-string safeties that can cover and can really hit and really tackle. So where you can have eight guys, eight cornerbacks, safeties, roaming around, lining up as linebackers, lining up as outside linebackers, and get you three Vince Wilfork guys up front, I'm surprised we haven't seen that sooner than later. But like you said, once somebody takes a chance, does that, and it works, you're going to see everyone around the NFL do it.
I can't wait. I think that would be just awesome to be able to see and very exciting. And, you know, maybe we stop putting labels as much on what position this guy plays or this guy plays. And you talk about the continuing evolution of the game in the 21st century and something that came out of this draft. First player to get taken purely from overseas here, this German fella who the Vikings selected, who they're going to try working out at the wide receiver and try to see if he can get his physical tools to really materialize. This is one of the aspects that I'm kind of fascinated by as well when I look at the game, because for as much as everybody speculates about possible expansion for the NFL, and you saw what they did with LA, the NFL loves untapped markets, they love untapped markets overseas, I've always had the sense relative to other sports that they've kind of been hemmed in. You know, you've had baseball, hockey, basketball, as they've had a lot more international players coming in, and the talent pool has kind of expanded. That's what's kept it from being as watered down as it could have been otherwise. So I wonder about your perspective on that one there, that whether or not this overseas crop of players, if it eventually does materialize, and you mentioned Gary Barnett earlier, I think he's been involved with some of the efforts to kind of popularize the game of football around the world. Is that truly the biggest key to the NFL being to expand beyond 32 as opposed to just staying with the American crop of players?
You know what, I have mixed feelings. Like I forget his name, so forgive me, the German wide receiver. I love the story, but at the same time with football, I think people get so caught up in the measurables and they forget that football, you know, you still have to play football on the football field. So the guy was, I think he was 6'4", 220, runs a 4'4", 4'5", and he did play football in a much lesser league in Germany, but when you look at the type of talented players that didn't even get drafted, Braylon Addison out of Oregon, who excelled as a receiver and as a return man for Oregon, led his high school team to the state championship in Texas, where high school football is next to religion. He doesn't get drafted, but somebody gets so caught up in the measurables of this German guy or the guy from Australia who was taken by the San Francisco 49ers. I think it makes for great stories, but I think you get caught up in the hype. Then once they put the pads on, once he's trying to get off a jam from a cornerback, you know, that's played in the NFL, that played Division I football for 3 or 4 years, reality is going to set in. So I don't know if American football is ready to go global as far as the talent, as far as the players. I know the fan base is there. And I just think it's a wait and see type approach. Until you get coaches out there and they're coaching these guys up from 5 years old on, I just don't know if you're going to be able to go to these different countries and truly tap into their talent and bring them over here to be American football players.
That's true. That's true, because with the systems that we've had in place in this country the last couple of decades developmentally, that's a very good point. It's also interesting, too, as I'm racking my brain trying to think of previous raw players that came into the NFL, maybe the most recent one that pops into my mind who have any kind of notoriety whatsoever, also the Vikings about 10 years ago, a little longer than that, maybe Brock Lesnar, real physical freak himself, and if he couldn't make it, getting back into the game there, yeah, that just shows you the challenges that are inherent, and like you said, it comes down to more than the measurables and more than what the stopwatch and the scale can tell you. Something that I'd like to ask you about as well here, in as much as, again, while it's been great talking football with you, this is the show where nothing is off topic, so we like to get into some different types of things here. I was very intrigued to see on your bio about going through the program at the Wharton School of Business of Pennsylvania, a very, very prestigious one, as everybody knows. And while I'm not going to ask, because this would be kind of an ambush kind of a thing, so I'm not going to ask a political question. Having said that, I'm very intrigued by the fact that you are a fellow product of the school of course, Donald Trump running for president right now. So I'm just going to ask you, generically speaking, and you can take this wherever you want to.
You can ask me whatever.
Okay,
you want.
Well, I don't want to ambush because it's a controversial topic. A real love him or hate him type situation in America these days. I'm just intrigued by your point of view in terms of being somebody that comes out of that school. What are some of the principles? What are some of the skills? What are some of the things that are imbued in somebody that comes out of that school? Again, because we now have somebody that came out of that school that's running for president. I'm intrigued on that level.
Well, I just want to make sure I'm not making any false claims. So the Wharton School, that was an executive program through the NFL.
Yes.
So I didn't go through the same program as, you know, Mr. Donald Trump. Might be saying President Trump here in the future. But what it did, it was awesome because, you know, my whole life I've always respected businesses, building businesses. And I've read the books on my own, but to actually go to the Wharton School of Business and have the same professors that teach and mold and shape the greatest business minds in the country take us through the classes that they go through, it was a valuable experience. Matter of fact, as you're sitting here asking me that question, I'm in my office here in Houston, and I'm looking at the certificate that was presented to me from that time. I hold it up there very high. I really appreciate what I learned, and it just taught me how to look at business, how to go through due diligence, what type of questions to ask, and those are things that I was never taught. I never had a chance to receive those lessons, and to this day, and I took that over 10 years ago, I still have all my notes. I still refer to them when I'm looking at a land deal. We had a real estate course that we took. I'll still refer to those notes from Professor Peter Lieberman. I still remember his name, so I could go on and on, but it was just a great experience and just really taught me, to sum it up, how to evaluate certain opportunities.
That sounds like a really, really awesome experience, as I anticipated that you would say that it is, because I can only imagine for somebody that has the skill set to be able to go through there and experience all of that, just how fulfilling that it must be. So I did want to draw around to, again, some of your post-football activities. Again, obviously you're doing the show at 790 a.m. in Houston, but then additionally here, from what people can see on ndkalu.com, you've got the brokerage, the property management going on. So for some of the things that you learned at the Wharton School of Business, previously at Rice, through your life experience, how are you applying them to your business opportunities today?
Where do I begin? And this is what I love about football and athletics in general, that I find myself – so what I do now, let me back up. I started my real estate brokerage while I was playing. I just wanted to make sure I had something to transition to when the day came that I was going to have to retire. And with my employees that I have now, I find myself telling them some of the same things my coaches would tell me, and I would kind of just sit back and laugh because it would just come out because it's so ingrained into who I am. But just learning how to work with different people, learning patience, learning coaching skills from being coached up and remembering what some of the coaches would do that would have a positive or negative effect on me. And little things is, you know, Coach Tommy Brazier, who just retired, defensive line coach with the Kansas City Chiefs. He's under Andy Reid's staff. You know, he was one of those guys, you wanted to impress him, you wanted to make him proud. And it sounds kind of corny because you're a grown man in the NFL. And when he would just call you up to his office, you're walking up there thinking, oh, crap, what did I do? And he just said, man, I just want you to know you had a good week of practice this week. And you would literally leave his office as if he just told you you're going to get a raise. You know, so little things like that. I had a young lady who's helping my administrative manager here in the office. And she started off, she was struggling because it's tough here. You know, we kind of just threw her into the fire. Then after she started to pick it up, just called her into my office and said, you know what, you're doing a good job. I appreciate the improvement. And I just saw her whole body language change. So playing in football, learning from coaches, something as simple as one of my other coaches using different colors when he wrote notes on the board, just so you could separate, so you could visually and mentally separate the topics that he's trying to make. I find myself doing that, the points that he's trying to make. The list goes on and on, you know, from how to reward people to treating my contractors, my agents like team members. It's something that I didn't realize how much of an effect the NFL and football and college was going to have on my business career, but in so many ways it is affecting it in a positive way.
Oh, it really sounds like it. And so many, again, like you said, tremendous experiences, whether it be with coaches or other individuals, to be able to bring to bear today. And again, as we anticipated, Andy, a tremendous conversation. We really love being able to get into the nitty gritty here with our guests and really kind of delve into things like we were able to do with you today. Please do not be a stranger, sir. Love to have you back on the program. Thank you so much for making time for us.
I'll tell you what, you're a great interviewer because I've been around doing a lot of it, and you just make it real easy to talk to someone. So keep up the great work and just let me know when you need me again.
Thank you very much, Andy. I appreciate the compliment. That's very nice of you, sir. I enjoyed this tremendously, and we'll certainly look forward to doing it again. Thank you so much, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge, mini-episode number 725.